April 4th, 2007, and open a public hearing on House Bill 5024. Mr. Brown and Mr. Lawrenson, please start at your convenience.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. Ted Lawrenson is an Assistant State Forester in charge of the Private Lands Program, and he is going to pick up where he left off yesterday to continue our discussion on that program.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, had a summary of yesterday's comments. We're talking about private forests, their importance in terms of contributions to the forest economy, and the concern that really had a number of tipping points with regard to sustaining private forests and that contribution. Forest lands do provide a number of future opportunities. One of those issues was raised yesterday in terms of carbon sequestration. That's kind of an immature opportunity at this point in time. There's some barriers, but it hopefully will develop as an opportunity to generate new value for forest lands. Obviously, one thing that is becoming more mature and rather rapidly is renewable energy through biomass electrical generation or biofuels. And again, the legislature's dealing quite well with that in terms of providing incentives for supporting using forest fuels for those purposes. I'll go ahead. Specific to the private forest program, this shows kind of the capacity of the program over time. In terms of the number of operations, the red line, that's increased over time. It's pretty steady now at about 18 to 20,000 notifications per year. Would say that varies a bit in the context of the complexity of the operation. The number of family forest landowners has increased steadily and rather dramatically, and we expect that to go up quite a bit. And our capacity rose and actually peaked around 93, 94, and actually in terms of total capacity has declined since that point in time, but the overall trend has been up. Go ahead. But we do have an Adaptive and Evolving Forest Practices Act, and the workload associated with administering the program has dramatically increased over time. And again, this kind of lays out some of the major events. When I first started in the program many, many years ago, we didn't have written plans, prior approval, those sorts of things. And now for a number of operations and operation areas, we review written plans as a mandatory requirement, make comments on them. A lot of changes in terms of reforestation, and those are higher standards, but we're having a harder time making sure those are being met. We got landslide and public safety responsibility in the late 90s that we're still in the process of trying to implement fully. And the board has adopted a number of rules, and most recently that occurred this past fall, and the board deferred implementation of those pending the outcome in terms of our resources, recognizing that we'd have a challenge implementing some of those new rules if we couldn't sustain additional capacity. Go ahead. Similarly, the forestry assistance programs, which is the other part of the program providing technical assistance and cost share programs, have also gotten more complex. Large number of those programs really relate to federal programs that we deliver, and the complexity of those programs and the accountability the federal government expects has increased quite dramatically over time, and it takes quite a bit more effort to just fundamentally implement that set of programs. We do have, go ahead, again, part of what we see to a large degree is what the outcomes we actually get in terms of enforcement really depend upon effort. And this is citations issued for violation of reforestation rules. Again, you can see they peaked around 93, 94 when our resources peaked, and they've been in decline ever since. And I just make the comment that we don't have good data on compliance based upon these data. What I can tell you is probably landowner behavior has not changed a bit. In fact, we know that in about 2001, we made a policy choice to really quit doing reforestation checks that are on ownerships less than 10 acres or less. So that's traditionally where we see the bigger number of violations. So again, effort results in outcome, as shown here. Paul Bell talked about the fire militia, and the private forest program really provides the central component of that. And these people are out in the field. They know where the operations are. They know where the operators' equipment are. They can bring that knowledge to bear and in terms of the forest fuels, equipment, and resources very rapidly on these fires. What this shows is the contribution of non-fire-funded personnel to fire suppression based upon FTEs by year since 2000. And 28% of our non-fire budgeted FTE is spent in fire suppression. Now, that will be reimbursed based upon the fire cost, but that's a huge effort that those people make. This just shows the effort in terms of actual suppression. It doesn't show the training time that goes into maintaining that expertise and knowledge. Again, that's a pretty substantive contribution to the program. It's very difficult to segregate our programs once you get that level of integration. That integration is important. Okay, go ahead. Again, another thing we deal with is insect and disease issues. Again, probably the mortality related to insect and disease factors is greater than the damage and mortality related to fire, particularly on federal lands. Again, a number of diseases. This shows a typical example of an overstocked forest and the outcome in terms of that. Go ahead. Again, we monitor a number of these agents over time. This shows bark beetle damage, tree mortality in Oregon, and it's a very important thing we do in terms of monitoring that and then helping landowners address those kind of issues. Generally, with overstocked forest conditions on federal lands, their forest health conditions will transfer their disease and mortality agents onto the private lands, and that's a significant factor that we deal with. We have gotten a fair amount of federal bark beetle dollars to address bark beetle problems on private lands, and that's been very helpful in the last several years. One of the key drivers we're worried about is invasive species. There's a specific question about sudden oak death, but I think more generally invasive species is a huge issue on forest lands. Again, things that people perceive now as native, like gorse on the coast, that's popping up in Douglas County around Roseburg, Tillamook County, and false brome, again, understory species that changes the composition of native plants. Invasive species are a huge problem. It's just not plants. It ranges into diseases like sod. Certainly addresses a number of other species. There was an article in the Oregonian about a non-native group of mussels that are potentially headed our way that causes all sorts of problems to fish production. But with regard to invasive species, there's really kind of a philosophy of how you ought to deal with it. Once they get introduced and then established, the spread rapidly picks up, and then you're into a basic problem where you really can't address the issue. And so trying to break that cycle means you've got to really get to it here to prevent the establishment. Go ahead. So the elements of a good invasive species plan would provide for really rapid assessment and detection of invasives and early detection with rapid response. And that's we'll go into the sod example as an example of that, both good and bad. Sod, go ahead, actually was first detected in California. It's pretty well established in parts of California, but more recently it's moved into Northern California, Humboldt County. First discovered there in 2001, with 2 acres infested. By 2004, 123 acres infested. Those areas shown on the left. And just for your information, the scale of these photos is all the same, so you can compare the areas. Go ahead. Again, by 2006, 3,850 acres. Basically, it's like a fire is blowing up at this point in time. It's established. Go ahead. Sudden oak death was discovered in Curry County, same point in time, 40 acres infested. And by 2006, we had 128 acres. And again, that's hugely different compared to the Humboldt County example, where they're 3,853 acres. Go ahead. Again, this shows for Oregon the number of trees infested, just kind of an acres infested. Sudden oak death is like a fungus. It's actually, I think, technically called a water mold, which is more than what I understand about anything, but it's a fairly complicated pathogen, and it's something that we really don't know a tremendous amount. But by 2006, we've got an upswing in the number of infested patches. Basically, we're seeing area new disease about what we found in the original infestation, despite our efforts. But again, it's quite a bit different than what we've seen in California. Go ahead and next one. Eradication is what we've set as our goal and policy. We've treated, and again, the approach is to look at those infected sites, basically remove all the vegetation around them and treat them with herbicides and burn it. 1,000 acres more or less treated. Most of that's been with federal funds and fairly expensive at that. Go ahead. We do have a monitoring program to make sure that it is confined. Go ahead. And again, we go out and fly every year and look for infestations for tan oak that are infected or dying. And then we go out on the ground and inspect those sites. We've got stream baiting locations. Again, this spreads through water and through rainstorms on the rain itself. And you can actually see some sense of pattern of the disease spreading in a northeasterly direction based upon the southwesterly windstorms. Again, this is our baiting sites. One point I'd make, it started down here and it's spreading kind of this way, and it's getting more towards federal land and more rugged and difficult land to treat. Once it gets to federal lands, the complications of being able to actually do treatments goes up dramatically because of ESA and other considerations. So we're trying to deal with that as aggressively as we can.
Yes.
Ted, is this where the current sites are, where you're finding the sudden oak, is this on private or state lands or federal, state, private, a combination or what?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, it's been on private land so far. It's got a little bit now on state-owned land, the Loeb State Park, if I remember rightly. Is that correct? And a little bit of BLM, if I recall correctly. But it's mainly on private. Got some photos kind of demonstrating the location of some of it. Is eradication working? Well, it's been eliminated from some sites. It's definitely spreading much slower than California. And at least we can say it's slowing. Whether it will work over time, quite frankly, we don't know. And certainly we're somewhat dependent upon the failure or success of California. But it does have a sense that we are being successful. At kind of the bottom line is the more time we create for ourselves, the more we can learn about sod, the more opportunity we're going to have to figure out better techniques and better opportunities to control this thing or eradicate it. So we are buying ourselves time, if nothing else. Go ahead. Again, if you look at the infestations, this is where it's definitely well established in California. Had huge impacts there in terms of the oaks. It kills tan oak, Oregon black oak, number of live oaks down there. It is a host on many, many species like Douglas fir and redwood. There's the Humboldt County site and the Brookings site right there. Go ahead. Again, this shows the kind of work they do. There was actually an Oregon Field Guide program on this last week, but it's fairly labor-intensive. Basically, they inject the stumps, the tan oak stumps, other oak stumps, with herbicides so they don't resprout. If they do resprout, then they'll sustain the infestation. You can see where the injected sites are on the one bowl. Go ahead. This kind of illustrates the initial place down along the Chetco River in a mix of private rural residential type ownerships. And you can see the little pockets where they started off with eradication efforts. And again, it's been moving this direction. Go ahead. Now it's gotten into more large scale infestations. Again, they treat quite an area around the infestation. It looks a lot like logging, only you don't get to harvest the trees. You get to dispose of them and burn them. And this is an example of that. Okay. Again, on more difficult sites, this is what it looks like. And this is one of our 2003 sites. Again, you can get some sense of the cost and magnitude of implementing an operation that removes the vegetation, injects those trees with herbicides, and then burns them. Very challenging, very difficult work. Go ahead. Those then are planted. In terms of the risks, this is how the federal government views the real challenge of where sod might spread to. Again, Oregon, Washington are high risk. East Coast is at very high risk given their oak species. They have to dominate. And again, one of the consequences, if we do get this spreading and we have a hard time exporting both our plant materials in terms of our ornamental species that are could be infested with it, or our logs, it becomes a pretty substantial economic impact. Certainly a challenging economic impact for the landowners now that, again, get to see their forest land slashed and burned. So there's a substantial cost with that now as well. So,
Chair?
Yes.
Can we ask?
Yes,
yeah. Ted, when you talk about controlling this, once you've discovered the mold on the tree, is the tree dead, I mean, at that point, or can you save the tree?
Senator Devin, Representative Gerard, members of the committee, basically the tree, once it's infected, is dead. We've got to deal with it, dispose of it. Yeah, there's no treatment at this point in time other than to dispose of the tree very dramatically through slash and burn and then rejection of herbicides so it doesn't re-sprout.
You don't need to go back to the slide, but one of the slides back here, let me see where it puts, it's supposed to be very far back. But it was showing, here it is, like in bark beetles, the percentage on federal lands and the percentage on state and private lands, or at least the actual areas affected. And it leads to a question about some comments have been made about federal resources and the management of their lands. Is it a recent phenomena, like 2001 forward, in which federal resources have diminished, or is it a longer term that federal resources have diminished? Because you seem to be like in a terrible position having, I think before you indicated that we have about 3% of the forested areas in terms of state forests. Obviously, there's a lot of private lands that you're also responsible for assisting with, but you're surrounded by vast amounts of federal land in many cases. When did they really start diminishing the resources in terms of the management?
Well, Chair Devlin, it's been a downhill slide probably since the early 90s. I was talking to the superintendent or supervisor of the Willamette National Forest about a year ago. In I think the late 1980s, early up to the early 90s, there was 850 employees on the Willamette National Forest, and he was projecting after this latest federal budget there was going to be 230 employees, and that's very typical of the disinvestment that's gone on federal lands, and it's across the board. It's not just Oregon and a spotted owl issue. It's across all federal lands in the country. Their National Forest, U.S. Forest Service budget has been pretty consistent at about $4 billion for a long, long time. And like we talk about, as that number stays the same and purchasing power goes way down, and to exacerbate that is the percentage of that goes into fire suppression has gone way, way up to the point where, don't quote me, but I think, it's eating into over half of the budget a lot of years right now. That takes out the ability to do anything else. They can't maintain roads. They're probably, we don't know this, but probably water quality problems related to forest roads are probably most prevalent from federal lands anywhere. You'll see the headlines about closing campgrounds and setting campgrounds earlier and opening them later. The wildlife budget's gone way down. And they are treating, from a fuels and health standpoint, about 10% of what they need to treat, according to most evaluations, per year. So every year they fall 90%. More behind.
Yes, sir.
And it's not just funding that has the federal land management agencies tied up in knots. A lot of it is also stemmed from environmental lawsuits and challenges. And I think a good example is their relative inability to use, for example, herbicides anymore, which was, the lawsuit was, what, in the late 70s or 80s, basically shut down the Forest Service's ability to use herbicides at all. So now when they get invasive species that start, you know, they'll go out and hand pull them and do this and do that, but it's just like anything else. It's ineffective, and what happens is it just takes off on the federal land. So Ted's comment about the sudden oak death headed towards federal lands is not something to be taken lightly, and that's why I think it's important that we look very hard at that funding package for sudden oak death, because there's no question in my mind, if that gets onto federal lands, we've lost the control of it completely.
Are you, from a layperson standpoint, are you assured that there, you know, you've identified these areas with sudden oak death? Are you confident that the federal authorities have evaluated their areas and whether or not there might be other instances already on federal lands?
Chair Dillon, members of the committee, our detection flight actually covers federal lands, and we actually do that in cooperation with the Forest Service. Actually, one of the real positive things about this is we do have very good collaboration with the Forest Service to the extent that they can provide resources, and particularly on the research side, their insect and disease program is very strong, and it's a very good partnership. I think that, again, I do have a handout here if you would like it that gets into some real detail on this, but it's a reflects the partnership we do have on it with the Department of Ag, the USDA Forest Service, and others. And again, the Ag Department in Oregon does have the ornamental species side of this thing, which is an equally important part of the equation. And so jointly, we've got to make that successful, or we're going to see some major economic impacts to Oregon. I would make a comment with regard to the federal process. There are been studies with regard to the road systems on federal lands that really do show problems with fish passage and water quality issues. But the most startling example I've seen of the difference in management, we're on a field trip with a number of folks, including the NOAA, head of the NOAA fisheries for this region, the regional director of the Forest Service, and her regional engineer. And we're looking at a fish passage structure that had been installed on the Lyman Industries land that cost about $15,000 to install, large arch pipe, and restored fish passage, quite a bit of land. And the question became, what would that cost the federal government to make that installation? And the regional engineer estimated in process alone, just to get the point of approval, we've got $170,000. And so for what we can install 10 pipes on private lands or state-owned land, process would be what they would be spending that on. That's a huge difference now. And so that's a really important point to think about in this whole thing. Woody biomass is a real opportunity, and again, we do have Senate Bill 1072 adopted last session that provides us direction on addressing that particular topic. And there's a number of opportunities around that. We call it basically a triple win. It addresses forest health, provides energy, provides employment. Again, what we're looking at here, overstocked forest, typical pine stand with treatment, density would be reduced. And this is a really good slide, because once you get these stands treated, then you have some more options. And in this particular case, it's been underburned. You can see the dark mark on the bowls there. Until you get these stands restored to near normal fuel conditions, you really can't run fire through it because it'll burn too hot. Obviously, you can't do that in a lot of places, but if you don't do it, the consequence can be, again, a fire that is much more intense and larger in scale and scope than what would normally occur. And again, the cost of fire suppression go up greatly, and again, public safety and other issues become major factors. Oregon has a substantial amount of wild and urban interface, and again, one of the things we try and do is to focus on that. The Canyon City example I used yesterday is a good example. That this shows the interface areas we identified for developing community wildfire protection plans. And those do represent a real opportunity in terms of addressing both fire safety and providing for biomass. One thing we often don't think about is juniper expansion, and again, in the early part of the century, the amount of juniper was very limited, and it's expanded to multiple millions of acres, even though people often perceive that as natural, it's not, and that provides a ready source of bioenergy as well. Once juniper reaches a level of maturity to where the trees reach a size and a density, they start desiccating the watershed and actually dry up groundwater and surface water flows and result in loss of herbaceous and other ground covers, and really changes the ecosystem quite dramatically. And some of these basins where juniper has been treated, it's actually restored surface flows and restored then fish populations that can use the stream. So it's a real opportunity, and that also can be one of those areas we work on. The Oregon Forest Resources is studying yes. biomass.
Excuse me for a second, Representative Garag.
Thank you. Ted and juniper, as those of us who live in eastern Oregon know, is the biggest pain in the that we could have. There has been over the past couple of years some real efforts to try to cut juniper and to use it productively. Is there anything happening in that area?
Chair Devlin, Representative Garag, the Forest Service and Oregon Economic Community Development Department actually have a position they co-fund that has tried to develop these markets. It's pretty small niche markets. Basically, I would think bioenergy is a really good opportunity, and I think from my perspective, this is one of those things where working in partnership with other state agencies where we can help landowners and even the federal government do ecosystem treatments, use it for bioenergy, and may require some support to accomplish that. It's a win-win still, and again, there's a fair amount of opportunity over Oregon's landscape to do that.
There's a publication to it.
Yeah, we do have a publication on juniper. If you'd like that, we could provide it. But it's a real interesting opportunity and something that people oftentimes ignore, and it's a pretty big deal in terms of ecosystem health.
Mr. Chair, I would like to get a copy of that. Okay, please.
Again, the OFRI study, I'll skip over a lot of that, but I'll again, the study looked at what's the economic opportunity in terms of biomass being able to pay its way. Basically, most of the opportunity is on federal land, but 29% of it is on private lands, and trying to get those to work together in a combined effort like under a stewardship contract is a real opportunity. And again, one of the big issues about biomass, bioenergy, is having an assured supply of materials, and that's been the biggest issue that needs to be addressed. Again, there's some real near-term bets that we can provide. Probably the biggest opportunity in terms of the economic side of this is combined heat and power efforts like going on in Lakeview. And again, there is a new plant going in there that'll provide both electricity and then heat for the Fremont Lumber Company's mill. It oftentimes results in some other opportunities. I don't know whether this is going to actually happen or not, but a company out of California that needs heat for processing foam, styrofoam, was also interested in co-locating and capturing that heat. And whether that plays out or not, I don't know. But that's the kind of thing that these sorts of things can drive. Go ahead and go to number 73. Again, basic issue here on achieving this opportunity is providing access to the long-term supply. And again, that's up to the federal government really to do that. I would say there's a number of success stories going on around that, but it's still a little bit early to say if we're going to be totally successful. I think the Forest Service is becoming more committed, and actually tomorrow I'm going down to Roseburg to meet with Umpqua National Forest to talk about opportunities down there. And again, this is not strictly an Eastern Oregon opportunity. Southwest Oregon represents a lot of opportunity as well. Go ahead. This kind of illustrates some of the challenges on the federal land side. It's next one, Jill. Represents the budget allocation versus the need. And again, we've already talked about that. I think I'll just skip over the rest of the biomass stuff, other than there's tremendous opportunity to address forest health and habitat problems, again, create some economic opportunity in rural Oregon and produce renewable energy, and go to 79. You've seen this map before, but again, this represents the hazard condition class for the forest land with the urban growth boundaries. And again, we're seeing an expansion of the rural residential areas into these things. If you plot the large fires Oregon's had in the last decade, it laid pretty well in those high-risk areas. So it really is important in terms of the public safety side of this as well. One of the things that we're very concerned about is efficiency in forest practices. And Representative Burley asked about the Watershed Research Cooperative yesterday. This is an effort that started several years back, kind of a field of dreams approach with what we call the Hinkle Creek Paired Watershed Study. We've added two since then, which are the Alsea and the Trass River Paired Watershed Studies. Hinkle Creek is all private lands. The Alsea is a mix of federal and private, but the treatment areas will be mainly on private lands. And the Trass River is a mix of state and private lands. So it's a real opportunity to look at different treatment regimes and see what their effects are. But the real importance of this work is that it's evaluating water quality effects, both site and cumulative. And nobody's really looked at cumulative effects in any research way on both small non-fish and fish-bearing streams, and then determine the process linkages between changes you might see in physical parameters like water temperature, nutrients, physical habitat, to actual outcomes in terms of fish and other biota. And that's really important. We don't have those data, and we've been trying to get that through this process. And it's something that at this point in time has been funded through OWEB grants and through a federal earmark, which may disappear or has disappeared, through Title III monies from Douglas County, and then landowner contributions from other private donations. And
over here. Oh. You're the only woman out here. It should be so easy. I just have a question for you. I read the Hinkle Creek analysis when that came out. A question I had is, what criteria, how did you select Hinkle, Alsea, and the Trass? What criteria did you use to select those different watersheds for the study?
Chair, Vice Chair Stengfelter of the committee, there was really several criteria. For Hinkle Creek, probably the dominant factor was the landowner is willing to defer harvest over a large portion of a watershed for the length of time for the study, which is a pretty big deal. It also represents a geology that we are very interested in trying to model, and overall we're trying to get three different representative sites on different geologies in Western Oregon, and so that was a pretty suitable site for that purpose. And then it had basins that were comparable, relatively comparable, where we can basically calibrate one from the other, which is part of the need as well. The Alsea site was selected because it was the site of the original Alsea study back in the 60s. It really was the basis for a lot of the forest practices, and it's really a fascinating opportunity then to go back and reuse those sites and also some of the infrastructure to get valuable data. And then the Trask, again, we went through a more thoughtful process probably in terms of picking that one out. It's very steep, complex geology. It's going to be a much more difficult site overall to implement, more landslide-prone areas, unstable sites, but again, it's got comparable basins and willing landowners, including the state, that are willing to hold off harvest to implement these studies.
So are all three, I mean, I've seen the Hinkle, are the other two completed as well?
Vice Chair Dinkelter, member of the committee, none of the studies are completed. Basically, Hinkle Creek has the infrastructure in. We've gone through the calibration period, and we've got 1 year of treatment. We're starting on the second year of treatment, and for Hinkle Creek, the way it's starting is we're doing pretty aggressive harvest on the small type N basins first to try and see what the signature there is, proceeding down to the small fish-bearing and larger fish-bearing streams, again, looking for signatures. Trask, we're just in the process of completing the planning on that, and we've got an OWEB grant in for the infrastructure. We hope to install that this summer. The Alsea, because the infrastructure is in, we were able to start the calibration process last year.
And so we're just in the starting.
And just a follow up, since you're using OWEB funds, are you also, and I think I recall in the Hinkle that you're looking at areas where restoration has been done and factoring that in. I mean, part of it is looking at where in these basins there has been restoration activities taking place, and, you know, using, I mean, especially in the LC where you have data going back, whatever, 30 years. I think that's a really good control basin to use as far as looking at, you know, the investments we're making, what kind of progress we're making.
Vice Chair Dinkle, you're correct. Actually, Hinkle Creek, there really hasn't been any restoration work there other than probably the roads have been brought up to forest practices standards so we can get a calibration around current road technology as opposed to older road technology, which is quite a difference. But other than that, there's not been any in-stream work. And Trask as well, that was burned in the Tillamook and then salvaged, and there's really not been any restoration work. The other thing that make Hinkle and Trask somewhat interesting, the Kalapuya and the Hinkle Creek have work by ODF&W in terms of adult returns for coho and steelhead, and the Trask is a life cycle monitoring site downstream as well, and we're trying to connect those dots. Again, one thing that makes these studies somewhat unique is we do have quite a bit of opportunity to collect fish behavior data. And again, these show people out electroshocking, which is about the way I can only assure myself to catch fish is with one of these things. They're really fun
cheating,
to do.
Cheating,
it's not cheating. It's really fun.
Madam Vice Chair. Something about walking around in water with batteries.
Yeah, electrodes.
Well, actually, there is some safety issues. I actually was in the Long Creek in Klamath Lake County area and with a summer intern, and he had a little leak in his wader. I was triggering the thing, and he's jerking like this. He was too embarrassed to tell me. But I finally figured it out and really made it fun. You know? He was a graduate of the Humboldt State, so I thought it was very appropriate.
Don't forget, you are on the record, Ted. You don't want to incriminate yourself.
You need to get going.
Okay, sorry.
This shows the treatment. The control watershed on Hinkle Creek is up here. The treatment watersheds are here. And to show the cycle of harvest. Again, it's about the headwaters pretty heavily harvested in the midstreams, the lower streams.
Again, pretty typical of the pattern of aggressive harvest on private land. And again, trying to find a signature will be a real opportunity here. But what makes this really unique with all these sites is we do have a number of passive and aggressive ways of tracking fish. And in terms of their movements, we're putting transmitters in a number of the fish, a large portion of the actual resident population. We've got actual readers in place in these systems. When Ralph goes up and down or changes channels from one basin to other, it can say Ralph moved on such and such time. And that's really a unique opportunity because you basically can say, okay, how did this treatment effect change both fish behavior and fish physiology? And again, we don't know that, and this is a real opportunity to look at that. And some of the data sets that we've got in terms of that. Go ahead. Again, the focus here is on resident fish, but we are looking at a range of other things, including amphibians, invertebrates, and trying to see the effects on those as well. So with that, I'll close my slide presentation. We do have, and again, I'm trying to hit on the major drivers and complexity of the program. We do have a number of key performance measures, to summarize those, we're not very pleased with these performance measures generally. We do have a number of metrics, and looking at like performance measure number 3, landowner planning and management plans, the percentage of family forest landowners that have those. Number 4 is stewardship forester efficiency, looking at number of inspections and improved management on private lands. Private landowner incentives in terms of funds provided to landowners, and again, that's somewhat of a metric in terms of federal fund availability and may not be a very good metric over time. Key performance measure number 6 relates to our forest nursery, which is a topic you may want to get into. Basically, we are in the process of terminating our nursery production of seedlings, selling the property, and trying to figure out an alternative approach providing speculative seedlings to failing forest landowners. And we've got a number of options to do that. And certainly the revenue we generate from the nursery sale would be used to provide that alternative. A number of issues around the nursery resulted in this decision. First off, we certainly did not want to be in competition with the private sector, and the private sector has been increasingly willing to provide seedling to a number of seed zones that we previously provided seedlings for. And then given that relatively substantial constraint in our ability to maintain a broader market base, we just really can't afford to sustain the nursery economically. So it was ultimately going to be a lose economic proposition to where we felt we needed to get out of the business and find an alternative. The next key performance measure is a metric on reforestation of private forest lands, and it shows a consistently high rate of compliance, but as I showed on the earlier slide, we're not out there looking. We really are measuring our effort rather than the actual compliance level. This probably doesn't have a tremendous amount of meaning at this point in time. Key performance number 10 is probably a better metric. It's private landowner investment. Stream restoration is a cumulative metric. And again, I would make the comment that it does represent the forest landowner's contribution to the Oregon plan, which has been probably the major substantive part in terms of contributions to the Oregon plan. The next metric is coastal abundance. And again, trying to look at an outcome-based metric in terms of the salmon plants and forest lands. But I'd be the first to acknowledge that we're not totally responsible for that outcome. And so it has some utility, but may not be the best of the metrics. Key performance number 12 gets to compliance, and again, that measures effort as well as compliance, and probably isn't the ideal metric as well. I would make the point that we've agreed to go back and adjust these in the near future. Number 14 deals with forest insect damage in eastern Oregon, which does include both private and federal lands. Number 21 is a new key performance measure, which would try to measure our effort and outcome on forest biomass utilization, looking at the number of bone dry tons converted to biofuels as the metric there. And again, that may be a relatively good metric, but it's also dependent upon federal land performance. So. Those are our key performance measures at this point in time.
Yes, representing
from on KPM 12, the Forest Practices Act compliance. Ted, could you talk about the 2005 legislative note and how that's been addressed in or is in this KPM, or what you've done to try to address that note?
Remind me of the note at this point in time. I do remember it, but I can't remember the details on it. Basically, we've agreed to review this in the context of some better metric of, it was suggested at the time we look at like acres or some relative approach of trying to define the scope of the work and then looking at the number of inspections or the compliance on that. And we didn't feel that was going to work very well. And so we agreed to basically come up with another metric, if I recall correctly, and we're still in the process of doing that. I would make the one point as well that we do have what we call indicators that really reflect outcomes in the forestry program for Oregon that are higher-level indicators that get to some of the questions that were asked about, for example, fuel condition across Oregon, and that's one of the indicators that we're trying to track, and that's one of the dilemma with forest lands where we do need to look at the broader scale is how do you really look at outcomes in a meaningful way. With regard to Forest Practice Act compliance, back in the early 2000s, we agreed as part of the Oregon plan to do a statistically valid analysis of compliance. We actually went out and did an audit, and we had hoped to repeat that audit on a five-year cycle. We've not had the resources to do it. And ultimately, that's probably a better way of really looking at a statistically valid sample of compliance. And it does show quite a bit different set of outcomes than what this performance measure does.
Well, yeah, and my point, this reminds me of when we were looking, I think, at the Department of the Water Resources Department measure that said of the water rights that are measured, who's in compliance, and it's the same thing of the, you know, operations that we actually visit, who's in compliance, and it doesn't give you the scope of how the Forest Practices Act is doing or how we're implementing it across the landscape. So I think if there's a better way to reflect that.
Sure, yeah, I want to represent Dingfelter. Again, a number of the things we've talked about is, like, specific to roads, is having a statistically valid sample across all ownerships, basically a road audit, federal lands, private lands, state lands, and looking at the connection of roads to the water system and how well they're maintained. Also, fish passage, again, that would be an ideal, and that is one of the indicators we're hoping to pursue.
You don't have a fish passage indicator in here?
No, we don't.
That's something that OWEB should have the information on.
Chair Dillon, Representative Dingfelter, that would be ideal. The COHO assessment looked at that. What we learned from that was you got to have basically a baseline to start from, and that's also missing a lot of this in terms of a full assessment of what doesn't pass fish. Now, ODF&W is charged to do that, getting more information all the time, but it's oftentimes missing federal land information. And again, to the extent that landowners aren't willing to allow access, which often occurs lower in the systems, again, you're missing information. So we're making lots of progress, but it's not ideal at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding KPM 11, the coastal coho abundance, we had similar discussion with OWEB on some of their performance measures. And as Ted pointed out, this is problematic in the sense that there's many, 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 many other factors that involve the numbers of coho out there, for example, ocean conditions, that the State Department of Forestry has absolutely no control over. So I just want to register my concern with these measures and encourage the department to work with whoever they need to get these things in a format that I think are meaningful and useful, not only to the department but to the members of the Ways and Means process. Also, ditto for item number 14, the insect damage. Anytime we're dealing with federal lands, there's just extenuating circumstances there. The department has no control over, no responsibility for whatsoever. So it just kind of makes the measure rather meaningless. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, I don't know how to affect the changes that I would envision doing for these things, but I guess I just would encourage however we need to do that, we get that going.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. On KPM 21, the forest biomass utilization, I know Senator Bakken is working on 838 and it's coming to the floor shortly. And I guess, have you been following that bill and all that? How will that affect your key performance measure? Or do you have any sense of where we're going with that?
Chair Dillon, Senator Nelson, members of the committee, I think the work that both the House and Senate have been doing to create incentives for both bioenergy and biofuels will set the stage for creating a demand for the product. There's already demand for wood, but it's going to create a stronger demand for the biofuel, small diameter material. And now the real issue is the supply side. And again, those bills, at least from the forest land, don't necessarily affect the federal lands and their ability to provide that supply. We're certainly working on that, and one of our policy option packages deals with positions to help federal lands as well as private lands address biofuels and stewardship contracts and other means. But I think the policy that's being worked on is really important for both the demand side and for the producers of the energy, but it's going to be a challenge for the supply side of the wood.
That affects your key performance measure in any way then? Or?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, will, and that was kind of the point. Is this, again, this is somewhat out of our control. Again, 29% of the economic biofuels supply is on private lands. The rest is on federal lands. And but you know, at least we'll be able to track progress and give you a broader sense of overall success. Again, I think tied to overall forest condition metrics, it would be a pretty useful set of overall criterion indicators to be used for looking at progress, but it's not necessarily a good program performance measure.
Right. Might just add to that. As Ted said, though, we've been working on a set of criterion indicators that would track what we feel are the key measures of the well-being of forests in Oregon over time. And they're pretty high level, and a lot of them don't register immediate impacts. There are things that show trends over time. There's about, I forget now, is it about 21 of those indicators that tie directly to criteria, and the criteria tie directly to concepts of sustainable forests that have been evolving, you know, internationally for a long time. The point I wanted to make, though, is a lot of times, even though we don't have a lot of control over what happens on federal land right now, and that has a big bearing on all of these indicators, it still is a really important discussion. And I think, you know, it leads pragmatically to the point, well, okay, 57% of the land is owned by the federal government and has a pervasive influence on Oregon in general. And, you know, what it does from a policy standpoint is direct us to spend more effort working at the federal policy level, if that's what, you know, the policymakers think is important. So I think it's important to continue to display that information, even though we don't have very good control over it. At least policymakers can tell us, you know, you need to keep weighing in and you need to keep trying to make a difference wherever you can, and we support, you know, the effort that you put into that. So,
yeah, if I could make a point with regard to our programmatic performance measures, one of the dilemmas we have is our data system is at the point that we really can't sustain the data to support some performance measures. We have an old system called FACTS that really can't support itself in terms of the programming, and it really isn't the need of update. That, you know, was part of the point of our policy option packages. Though I would make the point that to a large degree, again, this is about effort, and what we find, and I think correctly so, most of our stewardship foresters prefer to go out in the field and do work rather than report accomplishments. And so there's always that set of trade-offs you got to worry about. We certainly want to provide good data for both our decision-making and your decision-making, but that's one of the tensions that occur in these kind of human partnership delivery systems. And a lot of what we've really accomplished is preventing things, and whether it's water quality damage or other things. And so it's hard to measure prevention sometimes, or it's hard to measure those kind of outcomes that we oftentimes get landowners to accomplish that are difficult to measure, whether it's tree count or forest condition, whatever, it's hard to quantify.
Follow up on 11. It almost seems similar to discussion we had in another hearing, another department, on what should be not a key performance measure but a high-level outcome. And it almost would seem more appropriate that if you had the data, which I don't believe that you currently have, but the data on this passage might be actually more relevant data than this data. I mean, something that you might have some control over would be...
Devil, I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
On number six, did you indicate specifically when you intend to phase out the nursery?
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, we're in the process of doing that now. Basically, we are going to honor our existing contract. We've not sowed any more seedlings. And as soon as those the process to get the sale underway, which we've got to offer it out to other state agencies first, other governmental entities, and then once that process is done, we can start marketing it to interests, and hopefully it'll go fairly quick. The timing is going to be important, because basically it costs us to hold on to the nursery, and the amount of revenue we can generate will depend upon the timing of that. We want to, again, maximize the positive out of it and use those funds to introduce and create this new method of getting seedlings for family forest landowners.
And we've not put any new crop in the ground at the nursery. It's simply a matter of cropping out what's already planted at this point. So,
Ms. Jordan, might it be appropriate to lower the expectation for that performance measure and actually indicate that the intent is to phase out that portion of the forestry's operations?
Mr. Chair, when the agency, yes, is the short answer. So as soon as they sell the property, then this performance measure would go away. So it would be, I expect that the next biennium, that would be a proposed deletion on their list.
Representative Klein.
Does this work similar to properties where gas facilities or someone ends up selling it and conducting the sale, or does forestry actually do it?
We work with DAS and follow a prescribed administrative procedure to do that. And as Ted said, we've got an appraisal, and the first step is to advertise within state government that state property is surplus to our needs, and does anybody have an interest in it? Once we've gone through that cycle, and presuming no other state agency wants it, then it'll be going out for competitive.
Do you know of the physical layout of the property? Does it have river frontage?
It does, on the Umpqua.
Yeah. What?
Interesting. we'll be happy to take a bit.
Yeah, one more follow-up.
Yes.
I actually think that, have we done park shed or not?
Public hearing. We're going to work session maybe tomorrow.
I would actually like to see parks take a good look at it, because there's no boat ramp on that river between Yellow Creek and Elkton, and that's a long stretch. And I don't know if it can be not the whole nursery, but the river frontage portion with the public access option. Something I would like to see at least looked at, if it's possible to break up the piece and still have it saleable, because there's Umpqua River is a fantastic river. The public enjoys it, but that is a stretch completely inaccessible unless you pay to go to the Big K Ranch, whatever it's called there.
Chair Devlin and Representative Plum, that's a good idea. We'll certainly follow up with Director Woods and make sure he's aware that it's available.
And you'll get a chance tomorrow at his work session to follow up with him.
Anything additional? Seeing none, I guess we'll proceed. Thank you very much.
Next.
That concludes the private lands portion, I guess.
Yeah.
So
have you done the policy package?
Oh, I have. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I guess he doesn't want to. I don't know.
Okay. I knew I forgot something.
I did notice that you have actually a lot of bills that people have put in.
Chair Devlin, actually, a number of those bills are bills related to forestry, our bills.
Your bills also.
We do have, a number of bills, which I guess I will cover on that briefly. Two of the bills deal with the Forest Resource Trust and Stewardship Agreements, as we call them. Those are both intended to address providing services to family forest landowners and industrial landowners through a number of alternative processes. The stewardship agreement would allow a landowner to enter into a longer-term approach of managing their lands rather than the operation-by-operation basis. And through that process, we hopefully provide them a set of incentives that this is intended to improve upon. It doesn't get us all the way where we want to get to, but it's a good start. The Forest Resource Trust is actually a way of providing, at this point in time, dominantly funding for reforestation of underproductive lands or non-stock forest lands for carbon sequestration. It would expand that into some other ecosystem opportunities over time, we hope. But again, those are things that will add some level of efficiency and supporting the private landowners. We do have a bill that would put us on the Invasive Species Council. Again, we think providing a seat there is important, and I think the partnership we have with the Department of Ag and other agencies is important to build on. a bill related to seed bank tree improvement, which basically allows us to do R&D work in terms of creating genetically improved seed stock for family forest landowners. Next bill is Federal Forest Legacy Program, and this would allow us to apply this program outside of urban growth boundaries where it's limited now. You can see this as a real opportunity to address some of the conversion risks, particularly on the industrial forest lands throughout Oregon, but it's probably focused on Central Oregon. The rest of the bills really are not our bills. We do have a couple bills we've supported that would add some level of efficiency in terms of the regulatory program. The first would create a new civil penalty option for people that do not reforest. It would allow us to increase the civil penalty above the cap of $5,000. And this is not in this list, I think. I don't see it on the list. But it would allow us to increase the cap on the civil penalty up to the level of the cost of reforestation, so it creates an incentive that we can apply to encourage some landowners that don't want to reforest to reforest. The other bill would eliminate the requirement to apply the scenic highway buffers in zones that are urban or rural residential, and again, that would help us by not having to approve alternative plans for those kind of retentions, where oftentimes they just don't make any sense at all, and we generally waive them as a matter of course. In terms of the policy option packages, again, we do have a number of them. The first relates to, this is on page 533, Eastern Oregon Effectiveness Monitoring. That reflects some of the work we did back in the late 90s, early 2000s on effectiveness of riparian protection rules, and basically we do not have the data to really look at how effective those rules are in Eastern Oregon. And the stand types in Eastern Oregon are so highly variable that it just requires a lot more data and analysis to figure out their overall effectiveness. You got dry site pine stands to very wet site mixed conifer stands, and the kind of variability that we need to address requires specific monitoring. POP number 152 restores essential service level resources that have been reduced over the past 6 years. It would address a number of key areas, including public safety and landslides, riparian protection. One of the strengths we provide is a site-specific approach to resource protection. This would provide resources to do that in riparian areas, as well as provide for general improvements in our overall stewardship and staff resources. The third POP is our bioenergy POP, which has two positions proposed to implement the direction contained in Senate Bill 1072. Again, I alluded to some other issues in terms of sudden oak death funding and the Watershed Research Cooperative. Those sorts of things are still outstanding that we've had federal fund issues with in the past year.
Any questions, Senator Nelson?
There's not a pop for the sudden oak death.
Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson, there's not right now. The discussion that we had with the governor's policy office at the time that they were putting together this part of the budget was we weren't exactly sure where the federal government was going to be on their budget support for this. If it came through, then we were probably going to be okay. If they didn't come through, we were not going to be okay, and this would be a logical e-board request. So that's kind of where we're at right now. The federal government is not coming through, and we do need the money. And that was going to be kind of one of my wrap-up discussions next Wednesday with you all, is that if we don't build it back in here, even though it's not in the governor's recommended budget, and you know, there's a very strong likelihood that we'll be coming before the E-Board to request the money.
And Chair Devlin, committee, with regard to the federal funding issues, POP 152, I again represent it as restoring our baseline, but given the reductions in federal funding in some of our other areas, we're losing positions there likely, and so it's not quite as the level of enhancement we'd otherwise have had if we could have expected federal funds that we'd seen in the past. Again, we do have a copy of the upcoming federal budget in terms of federal forest lands and federal forest programs, and just using Forest Legacy as an example, they're reducing funding for that dramatically, and again, that has huge implications for our ability to actually implement that program in an effective and meaningful way.
Mr. Brown, given the time and given the fact that we actually have two more actual days, actually Tuesday and Wednesday, we do have the hearing at OSU on Monday, and given that all that's left now is administration, and the fact that I expect some testimony on Tuesday, but not the entire hour and a half, I think it would be best probably we wait for administration till Tuesday. That will give you actually time to close up on all your sections and actually answer questions for the committee, and might be far more productive than you starting halfway in today.
We're at your disposal, Chair.
Yeah. So with that, I think we will...
We will adjourn.
Yes. Oh, and we have an announcement.
Yeah. I just wanted to call your attention to a letter that was placed at your table there from Nancy Molina, who was unable to be here during her to testify. And Paul asked me to let you know that that was here for you. And then I also need to know who needs a ride to the hearing Monday evening. I know Representative Burley has responded that he will not be able to go. Representative Dinkfelder needs a ride, and Senator Nelson needs a ride. So,
and Representative Garrard is probably subject to being on call for the Measure 37 committee.
Okay.
Thank you,
Rich. So Representative Clem and Senator Vauquiyun.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask one question. In the administration portion that would be coming up, are we going to talk more about, I can't remember if it was a POP or if it was just a discussion about the project to update technology with the three consultants and that kind of thing. So that's forthcoming. Okay. Thank you.
And tomorrow we'll have a work session scheduled. So as soon as everybody gets here tomorrow morning at 8:30, we will get through the process as expeditiously as possible. And with that, I would also mention you also have the detail on the co-chair's recommendations. And if you haven't received it already, you'll be receiving another page of detail, which is actually literally the same information, but I asked Ms. Jordan to relate it to specifically by number to policy option packages so it's easier to understand. So with that, we are closing the hearing, and we're done.